Chapter 15.
"You see? You see?" cried Pavel to Velchaninov, the instant that the young fellow's back was turned.
"Yes, you are not going to succeed there," said Velchaninov.
He would not have been so abrupt and careless of Pavel's feelings if it had not been for the dreadful pain in his chest. Pavel Pavlovich shuddered, as though from a sudden scold.
"Well, sir, and you? You were loath to give me back the bracelet, eh?"
"I hadn't time."
"Oh, you were sorry. You pitied me, as true friend pities friend."
"Oh, well, I pitied you, then."
Velchaninov was growing angrier every moment. However, he informed Pavel Pavlovich shortly as to how he had received the bracelet, and how Nadia had almost forced it upon him.
"You must understand," he added, "that otherwise I should never have agreed to accept the commission. There are quite enough disagreeables already."
"You liked the job and accepted it with pleasure," giggled Pavel Pavlovich.
"That is foolish on your part, but I suppose you must be forgiven. You have seen from that boy's behaviour that I play no part in this matter. Others are the principal actors, not I."
"At any event, the job had attractions for you."
Pavel Pavlovich sat down and poured out a glass of wine.
"You think I shall knuckle under to that young gentleman? Pooh! I shall drive him out tomorrow, sir, like dust. I'll smoke this little gentleman out of his nursery, sir. You see if I don't."
He drank his wine off at a gulp, and poured out some more. He seemed to grow freer as the moments went by. He talked glibly now.
"Sachinka and Nadyenka, darling little children."
He was beside himself with fury. At this moment, a terrific crash of thunder startled the silence, and was followed by flashes of lightning and sheets of heavy rain. Pavel Pavlovich rose and shut the window.
"The fellow asked you if you were afraid of the thunder. Do you remember?" "Velchaninov afraid of thunder? And all that about 50 years old wasn't bad, eh?"
Pavel Pavlovich was in a spiteful mood.
"You seem to have settled yourself here," said Velchaninov,
who could hardly speak for agony.
"Do as you like. I must lie down."
"Come. You wouldn't turn a dog out tonight," replied Pavel, glad of a grievance.
"Of course. Sit down, drink your wine. Do anything you like," murmured Velchaninov,
as he laid himself flat on his divan and groaned with pain.
"Am I to spend the night? Aren't you afraid?"
"What of?"
asked Velchaninov, raising his head slightly.
"Oh, nothing. Only last time you seemed to be a little alarmed, that's all."
"You are a fool,"
said the other angrily, as he turned his face to the wall.
"Very well, sir. All right," said Pavel.
Velchaninov fell asleep within a minute or so of lying down. The unnatural strain of the day and his sickly state of health together had suddenly undermined his strength, and he was as weak as a child. But physical pain would have its own, and soon conquered weakness and sleep. In an hour he was wide awake again, and rose from the divan in anguish. Pavel Pavlovich was asleep on the other sofa. He was dressed and in his boots, his hat lay on the floor, and his eyeglass hung by its cord almost to the ground. Velchaninov did not wake his guest. The room was full of tobacco smoke, and the bottle was empty. He looked savagely at the sleeping drunkard. Having twisted himself painfully off his bed, Velchaninov began to walk about, groaning and thinking of his agony. He could lie no longer. He was alarmed for this pain in his chest, and not without reason. He was subject to these attacks, and had been so for many years, but they came seldom, luckily, once a year or 2 years. On such occasions, his agony was so dreadful for some 10 hours or so that he invariably believed that he must be actually dying. This night, his anguish was terrible. It was too late to send for the doctor, but it was far from morning yet. He staggered up and down the room, and before long his groans became loud and frequent. The noise awoke Pavel Pavlovich. He sat up on his divan, and for some time gazed in terror and perplexity upon Velchaninoff as the latter walked moaning up and down. At last he gathered his senses and inquired anxiously what was the matter. Velchaninoff muttered something unintelligible.
"It's your kidneys. I'm sure it is," cried Pavel,
very wide awake of a sudden. "I remember Peter Kuzmich used to have the same sort of attacks. The kidneys. Why, one can die of it. Let me go and fetch Mavra."
"No, no, I don't want anything," muttered Velchaninoff,
waving him off irritably. But Pavel Pavlovich, goodness knows why, was beside himself with anxiety. He was as much exercised as though the matter at issue were the saving of his own son's life. He insisted on immediate compresses, and told Velchaninoff that he must drink 2 or 3 cups of very hot weak tea, boiling hot. He ran for Mavra, lighted the fire in the kitchen, put the kettle on, put the sick man back to bed, covered him up, and within 20 minutes had the first hot application all ready, as well as the tea.
"Hot plates, sir! Hot plates!" he cried, as he clapped the first, wrapped in a napkin, onto Velchaninoff's chest. "I have nothing else handy, but I give you my word it's as good as anything else. Drink this tea, quick. Never mind if you scald your tongue. Life is dearer. You can die of this sort of thing, you know."
He sent sleepy Mavra out of her wits with flurry. The plates were changed every couple of minutes. At the third application, and after having taken 2 cups of scalding tea, Velchaninoff suddenly felt decidedly better.
"Capital! Thank God! If we can once get the better of the pain, it's a good sign," cried Pavel delightedly,
and away he ran for another plate and some more tea.
"If only we can beat the pain down," he kept muttering to himself every minute.
In half an hour the agony was past, but the sick man was so completely knocked up that, in spite of Pavel's repeated entreaties to be allowed to apply just 1 more plate, he could bear no more. His eyes were drooping from weakness.
"Sleep, sleep," he muttered faintly.
"Very well," consented Pavel. "Go to sleep."
"Are you spending the night here? What time is it?"
"Nearly 2.
"You must sleep here."
"Yes, yes. All right, I will." A moment after, the sick man called to Pavel again.
You,
muttered the former faintly, as Pavel ran up and bent over him.
"You are better than I am. I understand all. All. Thank you." "Go to sleep," whispered Pavel Pavlovich, as he crept back to his divan on tiptoes.
Velchaninoff, dozing off, heard Pavel quietly make his bed, undress and lie down, all very softly, and then put the light out. Undoubtedly Velchaninoff fell asleep very quietly when the light was once out. He remembered that much afterwards. Yet all the while he was asleep and until he woke, he dreamed that he could not go to sleep, in spite of his weakness. At length he dreamed that he was delirious, and that he could not for the life of him chase away the visions which crowded in upon him, although he was conscious the whole while that they were but visions and not reality. The apparition was familiar to him. He thought that his front door was open, and that his room gradually filled with people pouring in. At the table in the middle of the room sat one man exactly as had been the case a month before during one of his dreams. As on the previous occasion, this man leant on his elbow at the table and would not speak. He was in a round hat with a crepe band.
"How?" thought the dreamer. "Was it really Pavel Pavlovich last time as well?"
However, when he looked at the man's face, he was convinced that it was quite another person.
"Why has he a crepe band, then?" thought Velchaninoff in perplexity.
The noise and chattering of all these people was dreadful. They seemed even more exasperated with Velchaninoff than on the former occasion. They were all threatening him with something or other, shaking their fists at him, and shouting something which he could not understand.
"It's all a vision," he dreamed. "I know quite well that I am up and about, because I could not lie still for anguish."
yet the cries and noise at times seemed so real that he was now and again half convinced of their reality.
"Surely this can't be delirium," he thought. "What on earth do all these people want of me? My God!"
Yet if it were not a vision, surely all these cries would have roused Pavel Pavlovich. There he was, fast asleep in his divan. Then something occurred as in the old dream. Another crowd of people surged in, crushing those who were already collected inside. These new arrivals carried something large and heavy. He could judge of the weight by their footsteps, laboring upstairs. Those in the room cried,
"They're bringing it! They're bringing it!"
Every eye flashed as it turned and glared at Velchaninoff. Every hand threatened him and then pointed to the stairs. Undoubtedly it was reality, not delirium. Velchaninoff thought that he stood up and raised himself on tiptoes in order to see over the heads of the crowd. He wanted to know what was being carried in. His heart beat wildly, 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 and suddenly, as in his former dream, there came one, two, three loud rings at the bell. And again, the sound of the bell was so distinct and clear that he felt it could not be a dream. He gave a cry and awoke, but he did not rush to the door as on the former occasion. What sudden idea was it that guided his movements? Had he any idea at all, or was it impulse that prompted him what to do? He sprang up in bed, with arms outstretched, as though to ward off an attack, straight towards the divan where Pavel Pavlovich was sleeping. His hands encountered other hands outstretched in his direction. Consequently, someone must have been standing over him. The curtains were drawn, but it was not absolutely dark, because a faint light came from the next room, which had no curtains. Suddenly, something cut the palm of his left hand, some of his fingers causing him sharp pain. He instantly realized that he had seized a knife or a razor, and he closed his hand upon it with the rapidity of thought. At that moment, something fell to the ground with a hard, metallic sound. Velchaninoff was probably three times as strong as Pavel Pavlovich, but the struggle lasted for a long while, at least 3 minutes. The former, however, forced his adversary to the earth and bent his arms back behind his head. Then he paused, for he was most anxious to tie the hands. Holding the assassin's wrist with his wounded left hand, he felt for the blind cord with his right. For a long while he could not find it. At last he grasped it and tore it down. He was amazed afterwards at the unnatural strength which he must have displayed during all this. During the whole of the struggle neither man spoke a word, only their heavy breathing was audible, and the inarticulate sounds emitted by both as they fought. At length, having secured his opponent's hands, Velchaninoff left him on the ground, rose, drew the curtains, and pulled up the blind. The deserted street was light now. He opened the window and stood breathing in the fresh air for a few moments. It was a little past 4 o'clock. He shut the window once more, fetched a towel, and bound up his cut hand as tightly as he could to stop the flow of blood. At his feet, he caught sight of the opened razor lying on the carpet. He picked it up, wiped it, and put it by in its own case, which he now saw he had left upon the little cupboard beside the divan which Pavel Pavlovich occupied. He locked the cupboard. Having completed all these arrangements, he approached Pavel Pavlovich and looked at him. Meanwhile, the latter had managed to raise himself from the floor and reach a chair. He was now sitting in it, undressed to his shirt, which was stained with marks of blood both back and front. Velchaninoff's blood, not his own. Of course, this was Pavel Pavlovich, but it would have been only natural for anyone who had known him before and saw him at this moment to doubt his identity. He sat upright in his chair, very stiffly, owing to the uncomfortable position of his tightly bound hands behind his back. His face looked yellow and crooked, and he shuddered every other moment. He gazed intently, but with an expression of dazed perplexity, at Velchaninoff. Suddenly he smiled gravely, and, nodding towards a carafe of water on the table, muttered, "A little drop." Velchaninoff poured some into a glass and held it for him to drink. Pavel gulped a couple of mouthfuls greedily, then suddenly raised his head and gazed intently at Velchaninoff standing over him. He said nothing, however, but finished the water. Then he sighed deeply. Velchaninoff took his pillows and some of his clothing and went into the next room, locking Pavel Pavlovich behind him. His pain had quite disappeared, but he felt very weak after the strain of his late exertion. Goodness knows whence came his strength for the trial. He tried to think, but he could not collect his ideas. The shock had been too great. His eyes would droop now and again, sometimes for 10 minutes at a time. Then he would shudder, wake up, remember all that had passed, and raise the blood-stained rag bound about his hand to prove the reality of his thoughts. Then he would relapse into eager, feverish thought. One thing was quite certain. Pavel Pavlovich had intended to cut his throat, though perhaps a quarter of an hour before the fatal moment he had not known that he would make the attempt. Perhaps he had seen the razor case last evening and thought nothing of it, only remembering the fact that it was there. The razors were usually locked up, and only yesterday Velchaninoff had taken one out in order to make himself neat for his visit to the country, and had omitted to lock it up again. If he had premeditated murdering me, he would certainly have provided himself with a knife or a pistol long ago. He could not have relied on my razors, which he never saw until yesterday, concluded Velchaninoff. At last the clock struck 6. Velchaninoff arose, dressed himself, and went into Pavel Pavlovich's room. As he opened the door, he wondered why he had ever locked it, and why he had not allowed Pavel to go away at once. To his surprise, the prisoner was dressed. He had doubtless found means to get his hands loose. He was sitting in an armchair, but rose when Velchaninoff entered. His hat was in his hand. His anxious look seemed to say, as plain as words, "Don't talk to me. It's no use talking. Don't talk to me." "Go," said Velchaninoff. "Take your jewel case," he added. Pavel Pavlovich turned back and seized his bracelet case, stuffing it into his pocket, and went out. Velchaninoff stood in the hall, waiting to shut the front door after him. Their looks met for the last time. Pavel Pavlovich stopped, and the two men gazed into each other's eyes for 5 seconds or so, as though in indecision. At length, Velchaninoff faintly waved him away with his hand. "Go," he said, only half aloud, as he closed the door and turned the key.